name's Anna.
And I'm Montana.
And I'm Clinton.
This is the ArtCast.
We are super excited to bring you our first ever mini-cast. The rule with the mini-cast is that there are no rules. So
yep. Anything goes.
Anything goes. We could be bringing you a special guest like today, or just a little look into something that doesn't fit into our traditional episode.
Yeah, or format. Something that we need longer than like 15 minutes to talk about.
This is also true. So we're here with our good friend, Clinton Hamilton. Say hi, Clinton.
Hey, what's up?
Introduce yourself.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me in your wonderful studio. You have this like golden mic right here in this mansion floor.
Yeah.
But I make some art and paint some stuff, but I'm a design major, but I kind of threw the design out the window and I kind of just do a lot of studio now, and I'm really looking into a lot of painting.
Yeah. Clinton is someone that we've known for at least 4 years now. So we're really glad that you can come and be a part of this. You have a lot of interesting things to say about art, and we're excited to hear things you have to say and teach everybody else.
Yeah, so we're just here to listen and ask questions, me and Anna are, and Clinton's gonna talk to us about something really cool that he's really passionate about, and we're just excited to be tagging along today. So without further ado, if you wanna start off on
anything
today.
Yeah.
What have you got for us?
I've got this weird dude that a lot of people probably have never heard of. And I guess you could see him as like a supervillain, or maybe he's not bad. He's just kind of like a controversial figure. But his name is Pier Luigi Cercioni. And he is this Italian guy that basically controls the North Korean art market in the West. And to really, I guess, start on things, there's this thing in North Korea called the Mansudae Art Academy, and it's where, basically, if you want to be a big-time artist in North Korea, that's where you work at. And it's like a factory for art. And so you train to be an artist, they find you at like a young age, whether you can do art or not, and you go into schooling, and then if you're good enough, you make it here. And what happens is they have these like projects that they do, and they assign you to do strange paintings about, it might be the leaders there, or it might be propaganda posters or whatever, and you just make art. But the deal with North Korea is that you don't necessarily get paid, and instead the company gets paid, and you get just this shallow little amount of money. And so there's this guy named Luigi, or Pierre Luigi, but I like Luigi better.
Yeah.
But basically, he was like the president of like an orchestra in Florence, and he came over to North Korea and he asked about the art there, and they showed him this art studio, this Mansudae art studio, and he wanted to show the rest of the world the art. And so him and his brother, they came back and they got a contract with this art studio to basically be the only people to show art in the West from North Korea. And I mean, I guess you could argue that he's doing the world some sort of a service because he wants exposure to these North Korean artists and he wants them to be viewed as people. But when you start to really get into things, you start to see maybe a bit of exploitation, and that he's taking these artists and he's basically making profit off of their art that they'll never see. And an example of this is they have this thing called the Mansudae Overseas Projects. And this is basically where other countries will commission them to build these statues and to build these creations that are basically slave labor, because they know that they don't have to pay these North Koreans a lot of money because they're just paying the company, they're not actually paying the workers. And so these workers build these projects, and there's actually, it's interesting because there's one in Senegal, and it was built in like 2006, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and the statue itself actually stands for anti-slavery.
Huh. That's interesting.
Fascinating.
And it's interesting because they're building an anti-slavery thing basically with slaves of sorts.
Yeah.
And Yeah.
That definitely sort of undermines the purpose of something like that. To have... That thoroughly yeah. undermines the purpose of something like that.
Anti... Yeah. Okay. That's exactly good. Great. Wow.
But he also... I think what really puts it over the edge is that he runs the entire, like, structure of North Korean art towards the Western world. So the Mansudae Art Academy, or Art Studio website, is actually run by him. And so all of the art on there, all the art sales, he runs. And so they get sold, but then where does the money go? Because they have these art shows and people have these paintings, but it's what's actually happening with this money. And he claims that the money is being given to the academy or the studio. And it's, he says that it's basically this independent entity, and that this Mansudae Art Studio is one of the only companies that works by itself in North Korea, and that its money doesn't flow directly to the state, which I don't know if that's just a vague answer by him, because if you have a socialist government and you have this entity, then saying that the money goes to that entity, wouldn't you also be saying it goes to the state itself?
Yeah.
And it's just confusing, because it's like he's saying it's fair because the company gets the money, but the company doesn't really matter if the people aren't included as part of the company.
Yeah. What kinds of art are these artists doing and making, other than, I guess, the statues?
Yeah, so they do a lot of painting. Like, the item that they sell the most of are the propaganda posters, and these aren't posters like we see where they're just printed out and they're photographs. All their posters are hand-painted, so like old sort of World War era posters in the U.S., how you would see that all those are handcrafted, that's how they do it in North Korea. And you also see a lot of Korean painting, which is a lot of ink on paper, and oil painting is also pretty popular, but oil painting they didn't actually have access to until the 1960s.
Hmm.
But it's also, the oil paintings are especially strange because they all almost look exactly the same, because they do it in this style called socialist realism, where if you look towards old Chinese art or Red Era China, and you look towards the Soviet Union and their paintings, you see this socialist Soviet style where everything is very realistic, but it's also very pro-state. And so everything they paint, it's realism, but it's also a bit of fantasy realism, because they're painting North Korea in the most positive possible light, which a country that has these public executions and stuff probably does not have a lot of positive light. But a really interesting thing that they sell is there's this type of painting in North Korea called jewel painting, and it's where they crush up these jewels and these gemstones into a paint, and they paint with them, so you get these like sparkling tones and hues, and they're also really expensive.
Wow, I would imagine.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So this guy, he's still operating, or is he like, did he use, I think I missed out.
Yeah, he still runs the website, and he still runs sort of sales of the art he has, but there's actually been sanctions put in place on North Korea and their art, and so he can no longer really get new art because they're not allowed to bring out any, because the UN realized that this Mansudae overseas projects and all these statues was basically slave labor of sorts, and that mm-hmm. all these countries, they're mostly in Africa and Asia, but there's also, I think just the fairy tale fountain in Germany was also built by North Korean artists.
Wow. Huh. That's really interesting. Yeah. Wow. I mean, the, like, art and stuff that we see come out of North Korea is just a stark contrast to what we know is going on inside there, or just barely what we know, because we don't even know just the extent of what's going on there. And they're really trying to put this, like, face on for the world.
Yeah, and it almost works both ways, too, because we don't know much about them, which is the whole draw of getting their art, but they also don't know much about us, and the whole deal with that socialist realism is that they also, the reason they do that is because that's what's been taught to them as art. So whenever they do their own projects, whenever they just paint a landscape or portrait, they go to that because that's automatic. And when they've been shown contemporary or conceptual art, they see it and sometimes they'll laugh at it because they don't see it as art. It's like how if you saw just a random paint splatter on the sidewalk, you wouldn't notice that as art, but if you put that in a canvas, you might. And it's because you have this strange contextual understanding of the two, but they don't really see abstraction or conceptual contemporary projects as artistic in nature.
So what happened, do you know what happens when artists kind of branch out from...
Yeah, what happens like, to the rule-breaking artists?
What happens like when different artists decide, I'm not going to do what everybody's telling me to do? Or is it like, do they not even have an opportunity to like try new things?
Yeah, so they're given... Luigi likes to tell us that they're given the opportunity to paint whatever they want and that they're given these projects, but then they could paint a landscape or portrait or whatever they want to. And I guess in the art that's shown in the West, you don't really seem to see these outside influences just because they never think of making that. But then I'm sure there has to be people out there creating these wild paintings with just nothing but stripes or something. But, I don't know if the West would ever even have access to those, and if we'd ever hear the stories of the people that painted them. And I did read, I think there's a gallery in Turkey that, or it might not have been Turkey, it might have been Italy, that displayed a show of North Korean art, and I saw that only a few of the pieces there were socialist realism, and because of that, Turkey protested against it because of they didn't want to show that sort of oppressive regime towards the world, which is a little strange with how oppressive Turkey can be, but so I don't know what that other art looked like, and it's really interesting. I'd be really interested to see that sort of reaction towards that. And Luigi the Pierre, he says that the artists who have come over to Italy and who have come over to parts of the world, that they haven't really seemed like they're wanting to be out of North Korea and that they wish they could just stay wherever they went. But I don't know if that's just him trying to speak and try to get these people to create more art and to create a good relationship between him and the North Korean state, because one slip up and one slight against Kim Jong-un or the government could cut off all of his business and all of his profits. And so I don't know if we're getting an accurate view of the real relationship there.
Mm-hmm. It's so intense. It's something you feel like you see in like, I don't know, like a Pixar short about like, you know, a little character like being oppressed into this, you know, like gray landscape. But yeah, this is always what my picture in my head has been of like people in North Korea. It's just this like gray, bland landscape, but they really have art there, and they have this idea that they're living in a good area, like a good place. And it's a lot of brainwashing, I guess. And
on that note, Clinton, could you talk about the like chromophobia and how North Korea uses color to oppress?
Yeah, so you mentioned North Korea, you have thought of it as this dull, gray place, and I think that's what everyone thinks, because that's what I thought. But if you actually look up pictures of Pyongyang, which is the capital of North Korea, and you look up the buildings and the architecture there, they're actually filled with these super bright pastel colors. There's lots of this weird like coral red, and then a blue, and yellows, greens, pinks, and all these buildings are filled with them. And it's interesting because you would think of a place like this to not want to use that color, because a lot of the rest of the world doesn't use that color. But when you begin to think about color's usage and the way that people see color, you think about chromophobia, which is this idea of fearing color or fearing the power of color, or fearing letting color be used by itself. It's not, oh, that shirt over there is yellow, I'm going to scream. It's more, oh, I want this building to be painted white because yellow hurts my eyes. And it's that idea of saying that one color is better than another just because it's just because it has certain connotations. And so North Korea uses lots of color, and it's because when you start to use color for its own power, and instead of attaching symbolism to it, you get this state and where people can see the visual world more clearly, and where people can appreciate the visual world from a more unbiased and neutral state, I guess, to where they don't feel like they're getting ideas and bias and symbolism thrown upon them and thrown onto their eyes. And so you get a more free approach to the world. And North Korea is all about trying to make themselves seem like they're free and seem approachable. And you see it a lot with Kim Jong-un when he goes to these other countries. There's constantly cameras on him, and they're trying to get the best shots so they can bring it back to the North Korean people and try to tell them that he's basically saving North Korea from the rest of the world. And if you look at a lot of headlines, it's not Kim Jong-un meets with these leaders. It's Kim Jong-un offers these leaders the greatness of his presence. And it's more that speaking with Kim Jong-un and speaking with North Korea is a privilege of sorts. Kim Jong-un, he understands this concept of trying to appear better than you actually are, or at least maybe not actually are, but almost forming a different version of yourself. And it's almost like a dual reality situation, to where you're trying to present somebody with an alternate world of sorts. And that Pyongyang, when it uses all these colors, it's an alternate version of the space it actually is, because it's the city that's filled with tons of suffering and not good stuff. So like, there's tons of power outages all the time. And the people that live there, you see these giant buildings, but most people don't live in the giant buildings. There's this huge hotel that they spent like 25%, or don't quote me on that one, of like their GDP on this hotel. But it's still not finished and nobody actually lives in it. And so when you hear about like the North Korean famines, it's because they built all this stuff that's not even being used. So it was all really for nothing. So they're living in suffering. They're living under censorship. They can't leave. And this is the best you can get. You're living in the capital. And so it's all this suffering as the peak. And so it's this world that you really don't want to be in, but they're filling it with color. And they're trying to turn it into a space that you look around and you love. And you try to look there and you think, well, I want to be surrounded by color, but you don't want to be surrounded by color here. And they're just trying to make you forget that here part. And it's great to look at, but it's not so great to live in. It's not about the color at that point. It's about what you can obtain from color, which really you're not even obtaining it at that point. Because in order to get that sort of freedom and that idea of living limitlessly, you're getting the space that doesn't really use color for what it is. And so it ends up extremely chromophobic.
Well, yeah, I guess like those people, I know that they can't, but if they were to get their hands on some photos and like video of other major cities and see like the lack of color, like how terrifying is it that like one of like the worst cities, like most oppressive cities to live in, is like the most colorful, bright thing, these beautiful like art buildings. And these buildings look like art pieces, some of them. Yeah. Versus like a blander city that with less color, like New York or London. Even, you know, we see it as amazing because it's, you know, these beautiful buildings, architecture and city, but it's really colorless overall. You got lots of like glass and stone and everything. But like Pyongyang is like just vibrant, which is frightening. It kind of reminds me of Cuba, which is really interesting. Every time I was looking at those photos, like same colors they use. Mm-hmm. A lot of buildings in Cuba have those colors as well, the bright like yellows and oranges and pinks. I'm not sure if it's related. It's also like used to be a dictatorship.
Part of that could come from when I talked about socialist realism earlier, I talked about a bit of a relationship between the Soviet Union and that style. And I think some of this architecture actually comes from there. And so when Pyongyang and many of the North Korean cities were built, it was built right after the Korean War, when North Korea's closest ally was the Soviet Union. And so they sent architects there to learn how to build and learn how to create these buildings and statues and all this stuff, and you get this architectural style that's filled with these huge monuments, but also filled with these sort of strange pastel colors that they used in the Soviet Union. And it wasn't filled with all the bright colors you see in North Korea today. Part of that is more recent. A lot of the like shinier surfaces, like plastics and all that stuff, that's current innovations from even nowadays in the Kim Jong-un reign. But places like Cuba and places like those dictatorships, you can probably see some of that Soviet influence and some of that idea that you're trying to create a space to where the higher power and the state as a whole is more powerful and more free than each individual person within it.
Wow.
Dang.
That's so much. How long have you been doing research on the subject? That's like the one question I can think of right now.
Yeah. So I've always been a little interested in North Korea, just the idea that this society exists alongside us, but completely separate, and they're often forgotten. But I really never got into a bunch of research until recently, and I really started to research it maybe a year or two ago, and I started comparing it especially with South Korean culture and this real difference between these two nations that are growing separately. They used to be completely together, and they have a unified past, but a separate present and future for the time being. So yeah, it's really been recently that I've been getting into this stuff. There's always been some sort of a passion, but I can only learn more.
Yeah, well, like all of that was so amazing, and I'm sure I will make sure there are some photos on all of our social media of the capital city.
Yeah. We'll have some resources linked
always
on our Twitter and also
in the bio
in the description of this episode. But I have another question about North Korea,
yes.
But it's about your art in North Korea. So
yes.
You have a very unique style, and I feel like you kind of figured that out early on, but how has your studies of North Korea impacted your own practice as a studio artist?
Yeah, so when I paint like I talked about dual worlds. I paint like I exist in a world that I'm like a 21-year-old American man, but at the same time, I could be labeled a 12-year-old Korean girl. And it's sort of humorous to think that, but it's this idea that when you look at a painting and when you look at anything or think about anything, there's this label and this level of stereotypes that's given to something that they're not always true, and that by labeling anything, you're automatically making these assumptions about it. So when I say that my art is like that of a 12-year-old Korean girl, that's a stereotype in and of itself, and it's not saying that I have the experiences of these people on the other side of the planet, but it's this idea that if you're going to look at the world through categories, then you can't really look at anything because you're not trying to think about anyone's actual individual experiences or anyone's actual individual existence. And you're really trying to look at people as a larger society and a larger group, which is fine in some circumstances, but when you deal with people on an everyday basis, that never works because everybody's different in their own sort of way. And so when I look at my art, I think of it as not only myself and my own interests and beliefs, but it also what exists outside of those beliefs and what exists at the same time that I do. So I'm here right now, but then somewhere in North Korea, there's someone doing something, someone living in a certain way at the exact same time as I am right now. And I have to consider that whatever I do also has something that I'm not doing, and someone else is doing something while I'm doing possibly something or possibly nothing. And so when I create this art, I think about these people that aren't me and aren't my art, and also these people that don't necessarily have a voice to the rest of the world, because a lot of the times North Korea and North Korean people specifically are ignored from the rest of the world. Because whenever we hear about North Korea, it's always the government and it's always the threat to the outside world from the government. It's never about the internal threat and the way the people there face their own government, face the powers that rule them. And as long as they stay in their own little corner of the world, it doesn't really matter to us as kind of the message that's pushed through a lot of media and a lot of news. Mm-hmm. And so it's looking towards these people that don't necessarily have a voice and trying to not experience that experience, but try to get a better grasp at that experience and try to understand it better and try to understand that there's existence beyond my own personal self.
Cool. That's so cool.
Very eloquently put.
Now, Clinton has had exhibitions here at Belmont and I think also elsewhere around the world, whether, I mean, you had the one in, where is it, LA?
Yeah, I had a little piece shown in Los Angeles, and I also, a long time ago, I had a piece shown in China at a car expo. It was this weird, like, poster I made for one of those terrible websites that, like, they, like, get designers to basically, like, crowdsource something. And so I just made this poster in, like, 20 minutes, and they hated it, and it didn't win. But then, like, 2 months later, I got an email from them, and they're like, yeah, we actually kind of like your poster. So let's, I'm going to give you, like, $60, and we're going to hang it up in China. And so there's that.
Wow. What was on your poster?
I think it was like for Formula One racing, but it was like a fuel company. I think they make like they make like gas for these like race cars or something. I don't know.
Wow. Well, Clinton's work is amazing. We're definitely going to have his website linked as well. So you can go check
at the end,
out.
We'll make sure that he says how you can follow him on Instagram and
that
his website
well.
And stuff.
But I think we have some questions.
Yes, I have some questions. So when we do have guests, we're going to have some questions that we ask them. That way you can get to know them. So the first question, Clinton, who is your favorite artist?
That's a tough one.
One of them.
Yeah, it changes like every other 5 minutes. Like 1 minute, I'll see something on Instagram and be like, that's my favorite artist. And then I'll walk 3 steps and change my mind. But there's this South Korean artist named, I believe it's Xuong Choi, and it's X-O-O-A-N-G, and so I believe that's sort of the Chinese pronunciation of the X with the S-H, so Xuong, and they make these sculptures of people that are very realistic, and they're renderings of skin and sort of the human look, but like the anatomy and the placement of body parts is very strange and it makes you very uncomfortable to look at. But another interesting part is that they don't think it's uncomfortable, and that like they have this piece that are these giant like bird wings, but they're all made out of hands, like these floating weird like fleshy hands. And it's like, it makes people super uncomfortable, but the person who made it was like, yeah, it's these wonderful hands that are guiding people to the future or something along that lines. But they believe it is very hopeful and very almost calming to look at.
Wow.
That's so cool.
Yeah. We'll make sure to also link that. Is it a collective or is it like one artist?
It's one artist.
Okay. We'll make sure to also mention.
I found them because you mentioned I had shown in exhibitions. I had a solo exhibition called, the title of the exhibition was Hey. And I was like, I don't think I'm probably the first person to call an exhibition Hey. So I looked it up and there was another exhibition called Hey and this artist was in it. And I really liked their work. And so, yeah.
Wow. That's a nice way to find me. Like, I bet. I just bet. Someone else.
That's awesome. Okay, so second question is, what is your least favorite piece of art?
Does it have to be a specific piece of art or an art like style that I don't like?
It can be anything.
Okay, yeah. Well, so I paint. There's a certain type of painting that I just look at it and I try to be nice, but I just want to vomit. And it's... It's these like weird like acrylic like impasto techniques to where like fast drying acrylic when it globs up, it has this weird like half matte, half shiny surface that people love it and people do it all the time. But when I see it, I just kind of want to turn around and look the other direction. And it's normally, I don't know if it's the impasto itself or the fact that they use multiple colors when they do it. And so you get this like greenish, yellow, brown, with like multiple textures and surfaces that it builds up, and it just kind of looks like a weird like sewage monster that like came up out of the wall and it's trying to attack me. But if you want a specific piece, maybe like there's that Jeff Koons, like I think it was a flower pot. I know everybody likes to hate on Jeff Koons, but there is like a flower pot. I believe it was in France, and it just, I like flowers, but I didn't like that flower pot.
Yeah, we'll probably end up hating on Jeff Koons in a future episode a little bit, but...
Or just explaining.
Okay, explaining.
About Jeff Koons. So, the next question, I also, in my mind, added a part two to this question, so this is a two-part question. So, what is your favorite color? This first part, so I'll let you answer that.
That also, like the artist, changes about every 5 minutes. But recently, I've really liked... There's this certain yellow. It's almost like a sunshine sort of yellow, even though the sun isn't yellow. But it's not... It doesn't have a lot of orange in it, but it also doesn't have a ton of green. It's like right in the middle, probably with a little more orange, to be honest, actually. But it's... I haven't seen it a lot before, but all of a sudden I'm seeing it in a lot of fashion designs, especially like overseas fashion. I follow a lot of like South Korean fashion accounts, and I'm seeing this color yellow a lot that I really enjoy.
Nice. And then the second part to that question is, what color do you own the most of?
That's probably pink. It's either pink or... There's like a light teal, but it's probably pink.
Yeah. Cool.
Wonderful.
Okay. Yeah. So this is a question that you wanted us to ask you.
Yes.
So this question is, what exists that should not exist?
Yeah. So I thought about this question because I am from Kentucky. And if you've seen Kentucky on a map, you know that it is surrounded by zero water. It is all land. And the city of Lexington, according to my like 7th grade social studies teacher, is the largest city in the world not built around a body of water. And so I am just never surrounded by any water, yet I love seafood. And so I remember the first time I had lobster bisque was in this restaurant in Lexington, Kentucky. And it's just so strange to me that I was eating lobster bisque in a state... in a city with absolutely zero water. And I wasn't sure if what I was eating was safe or if it should exist, but I enjoyed it. And so I ate it.
Nice. Okay. Next question is, do you like any strange food combinations?
Yeah. At the cafeteria here at school, they have this like ice cream tub, and they have a ton of different flavors, but the best flavor in there is the cinnamon. And they only have the cinnamon like once or twice a month, but whenever they have it, I always have to get it. And I always get one scoop of the cinnamon and one scoop of the orange sherbet. And it sounds absolutely disgusting, but the little like bites of ice cream between orange sherbet and cinnamon are like the greatest ice cream on the planet.
That's so interesting.
That feels like maybe that would be very like a Christmassy, you know, like orange and cinnamon. Like that reminds me of like a holiday, you know, you like bake things and it's like cinnamon.
It's like
orange.
You're baking something and you accidentally like knocked over the wrong spice out of the cabinet and you're like, you're making like an orange like jelly or something and whoops, you knocked in the cinnamon.
How long have you been eating this strange food combination?
I feel like I didn't see the cinnamon for a while, but the first time I saw it was probably like a year ago, and I wasn't really thinking about my ice cream choices because I always get weird stuff and mix it together, but I was like, you know what, there's a lot of orange and there's nobody over in that section, so I'll just grab the orange, and ever since then, I've kept doing it.
Nice. Amazing.
The last question is, if you could put anything in the turbine hull of the Tate Modern, and preface... the Tate Modern has a turbine hall where lots of artists put exhibitions, and it's a really big deal. So, Clinton, if you could put anything in the turbine hall of the Tate Modern, what would you fill that space with?
I'd probably just fill the entire space with, like, blue jello. Like, I'd just fill it all. Like, I'd make Jell-O out of the building because nobody would know what to do, because you would walk in and do you walk on it? Because you're just going to sink into it. And do you eat it? Because people have walked on it. And so it would just be Jell-O all over the floor, and it'd be really messy and really sticky, but it'd also be really blue.
Can you swim in Jell-O is my question, because I want to go swimming in that, but I feel like I'd just sink.
Well, I feel like maybe.
Well, we're just going to have to wait till he does it, yeah, and we get our VIP invites to go swim in the Jell-O.
I feel like you would just get stuck, like, halfway through. Like, you, the Jell-O would, like, avalanche and collapse on top of you. Which should... You're probably going to have to sign a waiver here.
What a great way to swim in a Jell-O! Wow. Worst ways to die.
Also it would great. Also be kind of magical.
Also magical.
What would the flavor be? Would it be, like, a normal, like a blue raspberry? Would it be something weird that no one's expecting? Like cinnamon and orange sherbet?
You know that flavor that's just blue? Like, it's just blue. Like, that's the flavor.
What other things are that flavor?
Like, blue Gatorade. How it's just, the flavor is blue. That would be the flavor.
Cool. Great. That's amazing. Yeah. I can't wait till that inevitably happens.
Yes. Coming soon.
Coming soon to the Tate Modern.
Tate Modern, if you're listening.
Please.
Please.
Please make this happen. Okay, well, thank you so much for all of the knowledge you have imparted upon us. We will have, of course, all of those links and some photos in our bio and our social medias. So make sure to head on over to artcast.pod on Instagram for those photos, and ArtCastPod on Twitter.
Yes, and Clinton, do you want to share your information in case people want to look up your stuff or follow you
on Instagram? So my Instagram is at C-R-A-Y-H, Crayh, and on Twitter it's, I believe, at C-R-A-Y-H _. If you search that or C-R-A-Y-H, you'll find me.
Yeah, and we'll definitely link them in the bio as well to make for ease of use. So.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for coming on our episode and doing this with us. We graduate in days.
By the time this comes out, we will be done with college.
Have our BFAs, all of us.
Yes.
So this has been a long journey. I think we all met freshman year. Yeah. And I'm so glad we did. Here we are, about to leave.
Yeah. Clinton, what are you doing once you graduate?
Yeah, so I am ditching the design world, sort of. I still have, like, a part-time design job, but I am moving to Portland, Maine to begin my MFA in studio art at the Maine College of Art. So if you live in Maine, I guess come see my parents.
Awesome.
Clinton gets a variety of stalkers from the internet. Yay!
That's okay. More exposure.
Anna, what are you doing?
What's today? It's today the 1st. In 11 days, I'm getting married, which I'm super pumped about. But after that, the goal is to find a job. So hopefully I'll be working at a design company or as a designer, as a graphic designer somewhere. I also plan on keeping up my own studio practice and applying to galleries and things like that, which I think I've previously mentioned. Oh, that's our... It's just the wall. The wall makes sounds.
Thanks, wall.
Yes. Okay. We are currently sitting on the floor in my kitchen.
Oh, yeah, it should be noted. We made a pillow fort for this. This is a special day.
Yes.
I don't know what you're talking about. I already said this place was a mansion.
It is.
I'm sorry, a gilded mansion. Gilded microphone.
Mansion.
That's what this is. This is fine.
We are currently sitting in a foot of blue Jell-O.
Yes. I will be here this summer in Nashville working at a tech agency doing internal design with them through August. I will also be in June, the first week of June, I will be in Atlanta at Art Gone Wild, which is a really cool conservation fundraising experience. It's a week long where they invite artists to come and make art in the zoo. So I will be there. And then in the fall, we'll see. That's kind of, that's my... we'll see moment is in August. So I'm sure we're all really excited.
So exciting.
To it's about be to out be there.
A big new world with no homework.
No homework? Well, except for Clinton.
But he'll be doing fun homework. How many hours do you have to spend in the studio?
30 hours a week minimum, I think.
Wow. I don't know if that's a dream or if it's, like, kind of intimidating to me. But, you know,
it'll be great.
He's going to kill it. Well, thank you guys for tuning into this episode. We are so excited to continue bringing these to you guys, and we're just really excited to bring you all of this awesome knowledge from our friends and stuff that we're just excited to share about. I'm Anna.
You're Montana. I'm Anna.
I'm Anna.
And I'm Montana.
I'm Quentin.
And this is the ArtCast.
That's art, folks.
Thanks for tuning into the ArtCast. We're so excited to keep bringing you these. You may have noticed it took a little while for this episode to come out, and that is because one of us just got married, and the other one has been busy with an exciting new project, which I guess will be revealed next time. So keep listening, and we hope to bring you the next episode in the next week or two. Cover art was done by Montana Johnson, and our intro and outro music was done by Casey Catalbis. See you soon!